Welcome, everybody, to Health, Wealth, and Divine, also known as Jawanza for Life. I hope everybody's having a wonderful day. And if you have been having a wonderful day, this is really going to top it off. If you haven't been having a wonderful day, this is going to help to lift your spirits, okay? This is a show that we do approximately every 2 weeks on entrepreneurship. For those of you who've been following the show, you know that every 2 weeks we are very fortunate enough to have as our resident professor, Joseph T. Geiger. He's an author, he's an entrepreneur, and we are very, 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 I mean very fortunate enough to have someone with his experience to be able to come and share with us the principles that are outlined in his book. He's the author of two books. The one we'll be discussing tonight is Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. This book keeps growing and growing and growing, and I guarantee you, once you get into this show, you'll really see the benefit of having a guide when you're into your entrepreneurial ventures, because so many things can come up. I mean, so many things that are just unexpected, things that, as planned as you might, there are going to be some things that you just didn't plan for, but it at least is best if you, although you can't plan for everything, you can plan for as many things as you can plan for, and this book was written with that in mind, to help the entrepreneur to succeed. A lot of entrepreneurial ventures fail within the first year, but if you get this book, okay, you can increase the odds that you will not be in that statistic. So let me get to my guest today. Again, my special guest is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. He's author of Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 105 Business Principles, also author of Finding a Career for Life. We'll tell you about that book as well and how you can purchase that too. But in case you've never heard of Professor Geiger, after this show, you won't forget him. But let me tell you a bit about him. He currently retired. Professor Joseph Geiger grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. And over his lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, he's taught entrepreneurship and small business management in order to help people, just like you, succeed in business. And he has written Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top, and he now lectures and teaches. So, again, we're going through this book, principle by principle, chapter by chapter, but I encourage you to get the book, okay, because Professor Geiger comes on every 2 weeks, but between now and the next show, you could have purchased the book and read ahead, okay? So, class is in session. Professor, welcome back. Great to have you. Always a pleasure. Can't wait to have another powerful show with you today, sir.
Thank you very much, Jawanza. Looking forward to it.
You know, before we came on, I was asking you about one of your very first ventures, Keyport Marina. And, you know, I had mentioned, you know, as best, you know, as it seemed as though there were a lot of things that were being learned on the fly. And I said, something is the best learned that way. He said, well, not really. Well, I understand. Well, what I actually meant was that once you do learn it, if you do have to learn it, if you do learn something on the fly and you do learn from trial and error, and if you do learn from having maybe had some missteps or maybe bumped your head a few times, that lesson tends to stick, okay, because you had to experience whatever you needed to experience for the lesson to be driven home to you. So all of these lessons that, or these principles, are born out of lessons that you learned in business, and they obviously stuck because they actually became a principle in the book. So that's what I actually meant, Professor, was that, you know, some lessons, once you learn them a particular way, they tend to stick with you, and as opposed to having, let's say, for example, one of the lessons that you may have learned, let's say if you had read one of the lessons that you wrote in a book somewhere else, it may not have, you know, stuck with you, but because you actually had experienced some things, they actually became principles.
I think that's true. Frankly, I think that you learn by your mistakes, not by your successes. People who write books after starting one business and it's been a success, they frankly think that they're pretty darn smart. because things worked out, and that's fine. But what you really, really learn from is your failures. Because after a failure, you try to think through, now, how could I have done this differently so it did not, it wasn't such a disaster. And I think you really learn from those far better than your successes. Like, say your successes, you think, boy, I am really smart. And I'm just so smart. I'm smarter than everybody else in the whole world. Because look what I've done. It just worked out perfectly. What you really learn from is your failures.
Well, that's why, again, you can also learn from other people's failures, though. And that's why if you get this, everybody, you can, you know, really, really increase the odds that you'll be a success. You can stack the deck in your favor. And that's what you want to do. I mean, because when you're starting a business, there's so much that goes into it, so much blood, sweat, and tears, not to mention time and money, you know. So you don't have, you know, any extra time to give away. You don't have money to give away when you're trying to start a business. You need all the money that you can get. One of the principles professors has is that you can never have too much cash, so you don't want to waste cash learning lessons. So for the cost of this book, you can save yourself a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of money. So we'll tell you again how to get that. But we're going through the book principle by principle, and today we'll be starting off with principle 31, dead assets are deadly. Dead assets are deadly. That sounds like a very serious, principle, Professor. Could you talk about it? Dead assets are deadly.
Yeah, when you start a business, or more likely where you'll run into this is when you, if you buy a business, you're buying, and when you buy a business, you buy the assets, you don't really buy the business. If you buy the whole business, you buy both the assets and the liabilities. And the liabilities you probably don't know about, or at least you don't know all of them. With the assets, you buy the assets, and the book tells you how you do that. And there is a certain way that you do that to legally avoid buying the liabilities. You need to learn how to do that, and like I say, it's in the book. And that's one of those things that I would suggest is you read it, you make some notes, you try to do an outline, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then reread it and see if you got them all. And they need to be done in a very, very careful way. Otherwise, like say, you buy the liabilities. The assets cannot bankrupt you. The liabilities most certainly can. So this one is when you buy a business, you buy all the assets. And what you will invariably find in the vast majority of businesses, and I've not bought one, but I have been around when they were bought and been a part of it, and that's where I came up and learned this, that you buy assets, and you buy a lot of them that have value, and then you buy some that don't have value, or at least don't have value to the business. And the test is, does the asset that you have help you run the business and make a profit? And if the answer is yes, you want to keep that one. And if the answer is no, you want to get rid of it. Because if it isn't being used and it isn't making you a profit, it is a liability in that it needs to be insured. It's the sort of thing that can cause problems. So the assets you need are only those who help you make a profit that you actually use, and the ones that you don't use, you want to get rid of. So that's the purpose of this. And the assets can be deadly because they can give you a false impression of what you have, and that you think you have more assets than you really do. The assets can be fixed assets. So one of the stories in the book is about an acquaintance that had an old printing press that he didn't use, hadn't used for years. He was in the printing business, and it was just in the way, and then he figured out how to turn it into when he sold it, how to sell it for a whole lot more than he thought he was going to get. Another kind of more common asset is inventory that is old and out of date and maybe pretty shop-worn. And so you have it on the books at what it originally cost. You normally do not depreciate inventory. You depreciate fixed assets, but you don't depreciate inventory. So if you bought a business that has a whole lot of inventory way above what they really ought to have, what you're probably going to find is there are a bunch of it that is no longer really saleable. And it may not be saleable because it's shop-worn. It may not be saleable because it is out of date and new things have taken on. Every fall, you see almost all stores having sales on their summer goods. And it doesn't make any difference whether you're Walmart or the local shoe store. You don't want to carry through the year old inventory. If you do, what you're liable to find out is come next spring, when it again becomes the season to sell that thing, that for one reason or another stuff has moved on. You have inventory that's been soiled, and it is worth only a fraction of what it was originally worth. And furthermore, you're carrying assets that are not being turned into cash. And in business, the rate that you turn inventory into cash by selling it is almost as important as having the inventory in the first place. So there's a whole lot of reasons that you don't want dead assets laying around. And people do that all the time, particularly when they started. I did it. We were talking about it before the show, and I said it was the third business. It was actually the fourth business that I had. I ended up after my first summer with a bunch of inventory that was not really going to be sold until next summer. And come next summer, when we got around to selling it, we were lucky to get 50 cents on the dollar. So I would have been way, way better off had I sold it in the fall for 50 cents on the dollar, because then I would have had my money out of it, or at least some of my money out of it, instead of carrying it throughout the winter where you had all of that funds invested and it was just sitting there. So that was a lesson that I learned kind of the hard way, because I was very new to that kind of business and I didn't know much about it. And I learned a fierce lesson. And when you learn those lessons that way, you don't forget them very quick.
they tend to stick with you.
They most certainly do stick with you, big time. And that's, I think, another one of the reasons that the book is kind of different, in that in almost all of these principles, it gives a real-life example of where it came from, how it was applied. And so it kind of comes to life. And a lot of the examples are kind of like this one, where I didn't do it right. I did it wrong. And it cost. And you got to remember, when you have a small business, when you're working for somebody, it's not your money that's being lost. Mm-hmm. But when you're working for yourself, it is your money that's being lost. And if the thing goes under, you're still on the hook for all the debts of the company. And you may find out that not only did you lose everything you put into it, but you lost things you hadn't put into it. You might lose your home. So it's a pretty harsh lesson. And we also spoke before that, as you mentioned when we first started, that learning this on the fly is kind of a good way to do it. Well, it's a good way to do it from the point of view of remembering it, because when you do it wrong, you really remember it. But it's also a harsh way of doing it. And I would have a whole lot rather have learned a lot of these principles from somebody else. Unfortunately, most of them I learned from myself, and it was my money that was being lost, and so it hurt, but you sure remembered it.
You know, one of the things you mentioned in the book, in this particular section, speaking back, going back to the Heidelberg printing press, was that the person who wanted to, he just wanted to get rid of it. I mean, it was taking up space, mm-hmm. it was old, cluttering the place, you know, and he had, you know, thinking about, well, even if he wanted to take it out back, it was heavy, you know what I mean? Like, what am I going to do with this thing? You know, and I think he was going to pay for somebody to even come and just take it away, take it off his hands. And come to find out, he places an ad in eBay and finds out that people all over, not only the United States, but all over the world, want this printing press. And
yeah.
he ends up making $48,000, you know. And
yeah.
one of the things you brought out was that once something, it might not have any value to you whatsoever, but it's the customer's vote that counts. Could you talk about that?
Well, yeah, because when you sell things, people say, well, you price things having to do with what it costs you to build it and to market it and all of that. That's not true at all. You price things as to what people are willing to pay. And sometimes you know what people are willing to pay because other people are selling the exact same item. But oftentimes you don't know what they're willing to pay. And trying to find that out is it can be very difficult. And in this particular case, my friend Scott would have been more than happy to sell that Heidelberg press for $500, just scrap metal, because that's what
mm-hmm.
he thought he was going to have to do. And it was just the absolute pure luck that shortly before it was in kind of in the back of his shop, and mm-hmm. he ordered a new press, and that meant that he had to move things around, and at that point there was a path to get this giant, heavy old Heidelberg press out in the parking lot in the back. Up until that time, it was going to be very upsetting to the shop to move it. But he had to move it anyway, so he moved it out. And as things turned out, very shortly before that, like 6 months before, eBay started. And he was a bit of a techie, and he knew about it, which I didn't know about it. And I, when I heard him talk about it, it was a couple of years later. I wasn't a techie. I wasn't into that. But fortunately for him, he was. And he put it up for sale, not really understanding that it was going to get marketed throughout the world. It never occurred to him to market it throughout the world. He was fully willing to admit that he put it on there, and he did not think he was marketing it other than in California. It was a great big heavy thing. How the heck are you going to move it anywhere? So he thought he was going to market it in the L.A. area. He was in Phoenix, Arizona, and he figured that the furthest away he could possibly market it would be in the L.A. area. As it turned out, somebody from Peru bought it.
Wow.
He said he could have knocked me over with a feather. When he started to get these offers on it from all over, and he said he started to get offers the likes of which he would not believe, because like I say, he would have been happy to sell it for $500. And he thought maybe by marketing it this way, he could surely sell it for at least scrap and somebody would buy it. Maybe somebody who actually wanted to use it would buy it. And then he said he got offers in the U.S. Who wanted that particular kind of press for $1,000 and then $2,000. And then they started to come out from overseas. He said 10,000, 11, 12, finally stopped. The bidding stopped at $28,000. Just incredible. So he learned
wow.
about what the price was, and people say, well, how do you do it? Well, you price things what the traffic will bear, because the traffic is who's really going to decide what things are worth. The buyer decides what things are worth, not the seller, because the buyer, it's worth what the buyer will pay for it. And if you think it's worth $28,000 and nobody will offer you more than $500, it's worth $500. And if you think it's worth $500 and somebody offers you $28,000, it's worth $28,000 to them. Not to anybody else, just to them. But you only need one seller. So you need
and
one
buyer.
Seller and you need one buyer. You don't need 50 buyers, you need one buyer. Because you only have one to sell.
Man, I know he wished he had another that same Heidelberg.
Yeah, I had another Heidelberg press. A Heidelberg press is an old German letter press, that old style press where you set the type in a plate. It isn't a whole lot more advanced than the press that Gutenberg invented, except it was pretty automatic. I mean, where Gutenberg, you had to do things manually, kind of one step at a time. This thing, once you set the type, away you went. But you still had to set type. However, it was virtually indestructible. Those things were made not to run a million copies, but to run tens of millions of copies. They just did not wear out. And that's why it was worth so much, because people in other parts of the world wanted letter presses like that were virtually indestructible.
Wow. So the customer sets this. Gets to vote. The customer gets to vote.
Absolutely. He's the only one who gets to vote. You don't really get to vote. You may think you get to vote, but you really don't get to vote.
So, Professor, let's talk about for a moment, because I don't. You mentioned something that made me think about sales, and like for example, seasonal sales. And there are a lot of people. I'm sure I'm embarrassed to say this, but I'm sure there are a lot of people that felt like this too. I used to think growing up that when I saw a sale, that the person or the company that was offering the sale, that they were just being nice. I didn't think it was a business decision. I didn't know anything about business. I just assumed, I was like, wow, they're taking 30% off. That is really nice of them to do that. I didn't think that this is a business decision. They're trying to get rid of inventory. I didn't know then what I know now. But could you just elaborate on that point, that when a person sees a sale, that a business decision, they're not just – they don't just like you, so they're knocking 30% off just so that you can, put a smile on your face. There's a plan behind it, and it's a business decision.
Well, there's a business decision, and there's a whole lot of facets to it. And people who are in business need to kind of understand what the facets are. One of them is that you have summer shorts that August, you're not going to sell unless you're in Florida. But if you're here in Virginia or something like that, come August, certainly by September, you're not going to sell shorts. And so you need to get rid of it. You've got your money tied up in it. And I'll give you a real good example. Right today, you can go to Walmart and buy blue jean shorts for men, and they're $14.97. They've been $14.97 all summer, but shortly they're going to drop. Now I wear those kind of shorts all the time, and I usually buy a new pair every year or two as the old ones wear out. And because I am poor and cheap, I will not pay $14.97 for a pair. So I'm on the lookout. My wife and I, being old, we have our hot date. You young people really don't understand this, but we have our hot date every Thursday when we go shopping. And, and one of the places we shop is at Walmart. So starting last week, last Thursday, I took a pass through the men's clothing store, the clothing area, and the blue jean shorts were $14.97. That's how come I know how much they were, and they've been that all year. But I will be watching for the clearance sales. First, it'll show up as a sale, and then it'll show up as a clearance sale. And I will buy one or two pair of shorts sometime between now and late September for $5. And when they get down to $5, then I'll buy them. Up until that time, I won't. And I try to stay far enough ahead that if I misjudge it, I'm not out of clothes for a year. But I probably won't misjudge it because I'll check it every week and watch them go down, watch the numbers of them, and see. Now, that story, which is a absolute true story, I've done it for years, teaches us something. As the merchant, what you're doing when you do that, you bring your price your shorts down every fall, you mean that what happens is guys like me wait until they are on sale. Fortunately for Walmart, they are very, very smart marketers. And so what Walmart will do is they will let their inventory die, and occasionally they will run it clear down to zero. And when that happens, well, then there aren't any $5 sales. But usually they don't. They'll run it down quite a bit. But when they put them on sales, they don't have 200 pair of shorts. They may have 20 pair of shorts in the whole store. And a big Walmart store is going to sell two, three pair or more a day. So they want to run it down to, they probably have a target of 5 or 10. And so that's what they're looking at. And so they run their warehouse down to zero, and then the stores try to run it down to 5 or 10 pair, and then they go on sale. So they don't lose. Now, what if you have an item? Give you another item I buy regularly. I like a particular pair of shoes that I get at Bass Pro Shop, and they're $30 for the shoes. Three times a year, they put them on sale. And, well, they have one with that are waterproof shoes that are $30 and another that are fancier suede shoes that are $50. And they show them or they sell them off three times a year. They will have sales at 33 to 50% off. So I try to stay ahead. And I wait until I see one of those sales, and then I trot out and buy them. Now, if they didn't have that sale, I would pay $30 or $50 for those shoes because I like them. They wear forever. They're terrific. They're comfortable. And you just can't wear them out. And the one pair that I go, it takes me 9 weeks or 9 months to wear them out. And I walk 3 miles a day on pavement. And one pair of shoes will tolerate that, walking on concrete and asphalt pavement for 3 miles every day for 9 months. So the soles on those things are just absolutely indestructible. And the tops of them are truly, I joke about it, once you wear the soles clear out, you can use the tops to sand down concrete. They're so tough. They're waterproof. Great. But because they put them on sale three times a year, I wait and I buy them on sale. If they didn't put them on sale, I'd buy them anyway, but I'd have to pay full price. So as the marketer, as the seller, be very careful about putting things on sale, because if, at least on a regular basis, because what happens is folks like me wait until they're on sale and will not buy them at full price when you can make a real profit. They wait until I buy them at pretty much their cost.
Well, let me ask you this, because now you love the shoes, okay? You love that particular style, that particular brand of shoe.
Yep.
Now, outside of your own particular love for the shoe, I don't know if even how popular a shoe it is. And the reason I'm asking this is this, because there have been times when I've experienced this, what I'm about to share, and I know that other people have too, that you might have a particular favorite something or another, and then you go to get it at the store only to find that the store, they don't carry it anymore. They don't carry that particular item anymore, you know. And so I was wondering, had you ever thought about getting, since they come on, those shoes come on sale 3 times a year, you know, maybe stocking up, you know, just in the event, you know, just to cover yourself in the event that 1 year you go to get the shoes and you notice that they don't carry that line anymore for whatever reason they start carrying that.
Well, here's the test. Do they carry it in more than one model? And it doesn't make any difference whether it's a shoe or a car or what it is. And the answer in the case of the shoes, yes. They have black suede, light brown suede, dark brown suede, and this waterproof camo. And they carry all of those. And they have. I've been buying them for 10 years. And when I go into the store, once a year or twice a year, one of the things I look for is to see how many they have of not only the one that's for sale, but the ones that's not for sale. And as of right now, there's still a lot of them. Same as with the blue jean shorts. Now, if it's something that comes and goes, you got a different kettle of fish. In my particular case, I have a pair of black ones, black suede, that are kind of dressy. And when I teach or lecture, I usually wear those because I'll be on my feet for 3 or 4 hours. And they're very comfortable, and they're kind of dressy. I have two pair of brown ones, one that I'm wearing now and one that I'll start to wear here shortly, a dark brown and light brown. And I have three pair of camel ones, one that I'm wearing now that's about worn out, another pair that I have as the backup pair, and then one that's a full size too big that I wear when I go hunting in the late winter and I'm wearing heavy socks, and I have to have bigger ones to get in. So I have lots of backups.
Well, you know, again, and I'm really enjoying this conversation, you also mentioned, when we talked about sales, you mentioned the word clearance. Clearance, is that another word for everything must go?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, everything
whenever,
must go.
Everybody, when you hear the word everything must go. So
yeah, everything must go.
You can really get some deals.
in August and September, all of the summer clothing at Walmart is going to go. So all these blue jean shorts, come late September, they're going to have zero, none. And they won't have them until the next spring.
Well, what about stores? I mean, because the consumer is always paranoid that when they see a sale that seems too good to be true, like half off, 40% off, that the retailer probably just raised it 70%, raised the price 70%, not 40% off, and so you're still paying more than what you would normally pay for it.
Well, there are those who do that, and that's been done for years and years. It's less done now, I think, because people shop with their iPhones, and at least certainly women, you can ask your wife. I'll bet you your wife can tell you off the top of her head lots and lots of stuff that the two of you use all the time or fairly occasionally. She probably knows how much your socks cost and how much your shorts cost. Now, you may not know, but she knows. And she ain't going to be fooled with that business. And not only that, what will happen if somebody does that to her when she goes into that store, she just will not go into it anymore. And furthermore, she'll tell all her friends. So I don't think that's done a whole lot anymore. There's some clever folks who think they're being really clever, and they may do that, but I don't think that's done. And it's so damn easy to check. You can take a look at it and go to your little handy-dandy iPhone or whatever kind of phone and Google that in, and you can find out what others are selling it for at full list price right away. So I don't think that happens much anymore.
Okay. Well, everybody, we're going through the book, Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. We're on the fourth edition now, and we're going through, again, principle by principle. And this next one is very, very – I hope everybody takes notes. As a matter of fact, get the book, but definitely, you definitely want to pay attention. The six-step program – to solving business problems. The six-step program for solving business. This sounds very important, Professor. Would you like to elaborate?
Yeah, it is. And it obviously works. It's not just business problems. It's the kind of problems that all of us have to solve, whether you're in business or not. The only difference is that if you're in business, you get more of them. They come at you faster. They cost more. They're more difficult to solve. They have more ramifications because there's more people involved and usually more money involved. Mm. So that's the only difference between this for business people and non-business people. So the six-step program, do you want me to go through and just name the six steps and then we'll go through them one at a time or just go through them one at a time?
You can do the first. Go through them, and then we'll come back and then go through them.
Okay. Here's the six steps. And, folks, get out your pen and paper because they're very simple, but they are extremely important. Step one, decisions should be data-driven. In other words, don't make emotional decisions. Make decisions based on hard facts. Number two, define the problem before you can solve the problem. You have to define the problem. So, and you have to not only define, usually most problems have surface issues and buried issues. And the buried ones are the more important. If you solve the surface and you don't solve the buried one, the fundamental problem of it, it's going to come back and bite you again. Number three, set goals. In other words, you can't get to your goal unless you know what it is. If you want to go to grandma's house for Thanksgiving, it's real helpful to know where her house is. If you don't know where her house is, you're not going to get there. So if I invite all your listeners to come to a barbecue at my house, and I do great barbecue, but I don't tell you what the address is, you're going to have a hard time getting here. So set goals.
Okay.
Create a plan.
Well, you know, most of my listeners are vegan, Professor.
Okay. There won't be very many here then. Create a plan that solves the problems and minimizes the cost. That's four.
Okay.
Five, design a cash flow forecast plan, because I don't care how good your plan is, how wonderful your goal is, how well you define the problem and solve it, if you can't afford to execute the plan is no good, and you won't solve the problem because you can't afford it. So design a cash flow forecast that coincides with the plan. And number six, work the plan daily. If you figure out this terrific plan and then you stuff it in your desk and you don't look at it for 6 months, I'll guarantee you, you will not have solved the problem. You got to work it daily. So those are the six steps. And they sound simple. They sound almost elementary. But I can assure you that very few business people and almost nobody follows this system on problems that they have in their lives. And if you do, it doesn't make any difference whether you're trying to define how you're going to go to college or how you're going to make your next business work or anything else. If you follow this, your solutions will be better. You will make far fewer mistakes. And if you're in business, you'll make a lot more profit.
Professor, could you repeat number four?
Number four is create a plan to solve the problem and minimize costs.
Okay.
So, and the fifth one is to design a cash flow forecast. So it sounds like I'm saying the same thing twice, but I'm really not. So if you're going to college and you're trying to solve these problems, you've got the problem of you're going to college. Well, one of them is create a plan that solves the problem and minimizes the cost. Well, how do you minimize the cost? You can go there, go to a college, and stay in a fancy motel or hotel and eat out every night. And then you plan what it costs you to do that, or you can go to a dormitory and eat at the college commissary every night, or maybe you can rent a basement apartment from a little old lady like I did in Colorado and cook your own meals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all three of these are plans that solve the problem of living, but they don't necessarily minimize the cost. All three of them have different costs, and there are declining costs depending upon which one you choose.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the least expensive is to rent a little basement apartment where you may think you've turned into a chipmunk, and you're living underground, but it's very inexpensive. But of course, you don't get to commiserate with your friends every day. You don't get to chase girls quite so much because they're at the dorms and you're not. But it does cut the cost down. And then each one of them, you would do a cash flow forecast. And I'll assure you, the last one will be the least expensive.
Well, let's look at number one. Again, decisions
okay.
should be data-driven. A lot of times
right.
people make decisions on feelings or emotions. You know, they have a strong hunch about this or a hunch about that, or they may feel really strongly about something, or, you know, just emotionally making decisions based off of feelings and emotions. If you talk about the danger of that, I mean, and the pros of making decisions based on data.
Well, or another one, you get angry about something. You personally like something, and so your decision is made on all of those kind of bases. Well, this is the decision should be data driven. Actually, this one I got from my daughter, and I was worrying over something that the Chinese philosopher and general Sun Tzu said. And Sun Tzu said, let's see if I can remember, organize facts and create so you can create actions based on your organized facts, something like that. But it was in sort of, if you've ever read any Chinese, old Chinese books that have been translated, they have kind of an odd dialect to them in the translation. And so I mentioned that to my daughter, and Michaela said, decisions should be data-driven. And I said, wow, that solves the whole, that says everything that needs to be said. So you, in other words, you need to create, understand the facts around there and see where the facts take you. And if you don't do that, all of these six things build one upon the other. And if you miss one of them, it ain't going to work. You got to do all six. And I would strongly recommend you do all six in writing. So you decide what the facts are. And then you define the problem, what really is the problem, and so on down. But the facts need to be really, you need to really understand what those facts are. Oh, here it is. Knowledge and use information to focus resources. That was the translation of what Sun Tzu said in his wonderful book, The Art of War.
Michaela,
knowledge.
He translated Sun Tzu perfectly.
The translation of seek knowledge and use information to focus resources is one of the translations of Sun Tzu's book. And I couldn't get anywhere with that. And I mentioned it to Michaela, and whammo, there it was.
She put it in English. I mean, she put it put it in layman's terms for those who couldn't understand the Sun Tzu translation. She drove it home.
Right. She definitely did.
Data. Well, and an example of that could be, for example, somebody might be looking at the books, and the books show that based on the finances or the accounts receivables, you know, versus the accounts payables, that they need to maybe downsize, for example. And they might be looking at the people that they've hired, and, you know, let's say they may have hired family members, you know. They may have hired family members, and they're like, wow, if I let this person go, then I might be taking food off of my nephew's plate because I hired my father. You know what I mean? You know, I might be taking food off of my, you know, a relative plate.
Don't do that. let me give you a simpler example. Let's say you buy a company, and we'll make it a small retail company that sells stuff to other businesses. So you look at the inventory. So you have the facts of what the inventory are. You know you have so many pairs of work socks. So that is part of the data, but it's only part of the data. The other part of the data is how many pairs of work socks should I have in order to maintain the sales that historically accrued from selling work socks. So that's a whole different question. So we have 40 pairs of work socks, and we find out that we sell 30 pairs a week. Do we have too many pairs? No. We sell 5 pairs a week. Do we have too many pairs? Oh, I guess so. I mean, that's 8 weeks worth of work socks.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the facts here? What is the real data? Well, the data is that we have 40 pairs of work socks, and we actually need 15 pairs. So what do we do? So that's the data, that the decision should be data-driven. There's two kinds of data. What is the hard data of we have 40 pairs of work socks? That's the hard data. But other parts of the data is how many do we need? And the answer is 15, because 15 would give us 3 weeks worth of selling work socks, and that's a God's plenty.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what we're talking about here. decisions should be data-driven, what the facts are, and what should they be in order to do the job that we want done.
And the facts don't lie.
No,
you know,
no.
And the facts,
so right then, right shortly, the 2 days after you bought the business, some work sock salesman comes in and says, "Oh, hey, the previous owner always had 60 pairs of work socks." And so you say, "Oh, yeah, okay, well, I'll buy another 20 pair." Why are you doing that? That's an emotional reaction.
Mm.
You just made an emotional decision that means instead of having almost three times too many work socks, now you have almost six times too many, or four times too many work socks. So, you know, you made an emotional decision that hurt you. Before, what you should have done is say, "Hey, pal, come back in a week or give me a call in the week and I'll tell you whether I'm up for it." And in that week is when you find out how many pair have we historically sold. And once you find that out, then you know how to answer the man. "No, I don't need any more," or "Come back in 3 months," or "Come back in 3 weeks, because then I may."
You know, Professor, I'm looking at number two, define the problem before you can solve the problem, and I don't want to rush through it because this is a good one. Because a lot of times people might encounter a situation but really haven't pulled back the layers of the issue to determine where the origin or the root or the actual cause is. They just know they're having trouble. They know they're having problems, but might not be able to really pinpoint the problem. This is a very important lesson here.
Yeah, I think so. It's all well and good to say that we have a problem, and that you need to solve the underlying problem before you move on. But precisely how do you do that? And precisely how you do that is extraordinarily important. It's one thing to know that this is what you should do. It's quite another to know how you do it. And I'm very proud of the fact on my book that it tells you how you execute things. Because if you don't know how to execute them, they're not any good to you. You know, if I tell you, "Well, to solve problems, you gotta be able to define the problem," and you say, "Oh yeah, that really sounds right." Well, how do you do that? And if you haven't answered that question, you haven't answered any question.
Well, you know, again, that's one of the beauties of the book. Again, there are a lot of examples. It's applicable. You can actually, you know, when you read the book, you can actually look at the examples and see how the principle was applied. And it might not be the exact same example in your particular life, but you can see through the example of, oh, this is how he's approaching this particular principle. And then you can take that and benefit from it. But you can't benefit from it if you don't get the book. So let's tell them how they can get your
okay,
so
you can get the book two ways.
Yes.
You can get the book two ways. One is at Amazon. They have them. And when you go to Amazon, go to the books and type in Entrepreneurial Success 105 Business Principles. And you need to have the 105 Business Principles because, quite frankly, there are quite a few Entrepreneurial Success books out there. And otherwise, you'll have to go through them. But if you type in the 105 principles, it'll take you right to it. And they'll be happy to send you a book. And if you like, you can. It is the fourth edition, by the way, of the Entrepreneurial Success books that I've written. And the other way is to go to my website, which is you need to type in the road to the top.com, and I'll be happy to send you a book, and the difference is that I will sign it. Otherwise, they're the same. Same price, too.
And they can get the cash flow forecast, too. You've talked about that in the book and the importance of that.
Yeah, and there's a, when you get to the point where you need a cash flow forecast, I have one in the book. It's a fill-in-the-blank one. It's a very, very thorough. It's made for it can be used for businesses that are very involved businesses, but it also works for a simple business. If you have a store that a shoe repair store and you're a one-man store, it works for that. And if you're running a new Ford car agency with all of the ramifications of that, it works for that too. So the only difference is if you have the simple business, you just don't have to. There's be a whole lot of questions in there that you don't have to fill out because they don't apply. And but it's thorough enough that it forces you to think through what you're doing, and that's what they should do. The real simple ones that you find cash flow forecasts that are a single page that ask you how many items you're going to sell in a year are totally worthless. They need to ask you how many you're going to sell per month for the first year, for the first 12 months, and what is your estimated electric cost for each of the first 12 months, and then it asks you the same thing for the next 2 years, but quarterly. And when you get through, you'll have thought through your business very, very carefully. And that's what it's designed to do, because you don't want to run out of money, and running out of money means that if you need $5,000 this coming Monday and you don't have it until next Monday, you're broke and you're going to miss payroll. You're out of business, even though you're going to have the money, but you're not going to have it when you need it. So it tells you both how much you need and when you need it.
You know, and this book is designed to help you to succeed. You know, I want to stress that point, because what is the stat, Professor, of how many businesses startups fail within the first year, over 50%?
Half.
Wow.
Fail in the first year. By the end of the third year, there's only a quarter remaining of the ones who started. And by the third generation, there's only 3% that are still going.
You know,
now, many of them may have been sold, but it's still, the attrition rate is terrific.
You know, what's interesting about that is that those who make it through the first year that aren't in that staggering number that fail within the first year and they fail within the second year, it just sounds like some things that they were doing in the first year just hadn't caught up with them yet.
I think that's true.
And they just caught up with the second year, you know.
Yep.
So we want to make sure
We
want to make sure that you are successful in your business. So you want to, again, stack the odds in your favor. Get the book, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. We're on the fourth edition. And make sure you check out the archives. Professor Geiger, again, comes on every 2 weeks. And so we've got shows like, for example, today's show, How Entrepreneurs View Financial Statements. This is part four of this particular principle. Parts 3, 2, and 1 are also in the archives, and all of the previous lectures, shall I say, that Professor has given with us, the shows that he's done with us on entrepreneurial success, all of those shows are in the archives as well. So if you're just tuning in and you're like, oh man, I'm really enjoying this, this was a great show, you can get brought up to speed. You can go back in the archives and listen to all of the other shows that Professor Geiger is done with us as well. So I encourage you to do that. And also, lastly, before we go, let you know, Professor Geiger has written another book called Finding a Career for Life. And we've done some shows on that are in the archives as well. If you've got a young person in your life, or you're at a point in your life and you may be thinking about making a career change, but certainly for for young people who might not know which way they want to go in terms of career, if they want to go to college, where are the jobs, what are the best-paying jobs, you definitely need to get this book, okay? Finding a Career for Life, also written by Professor Joseph Geiger. They can get that at the same website, correct, Professor?
Correct. Yep, they sure can. And it is hard, totally unbiased facts. I have no agenda. The problem with most young people when they try to get that sort of information, they gotta wade through agenda, and an awful lot of it is the agenda is, well, you have to have a college degree in order to get a good job, which is patently not true. For example, it requires no college degree to be an airline pilot. That requires learning how to fly, having the right licenses, but none of it has to do with college degrees. There's a whole lot of great business opportunities that do not require a college degree. I'm not trying to downplay the desirability of a college degree. I'm just trying to say that there's lots and lots of options out there, and this little book, it's only about 75, 80 pages long, will tell you the unbiased truth of what it's like. Also tells you what people who are doing that particular job think of it. And that's one thing that a lot of young people want to know. Am I going to enjoy it, or am I going to hate it? And in most cases, all they can do is make a wild, wild guess at whether they will enjoy it. Well, maybe if you found out that 80% of the people who are doing the job really love it, or that only 20% of the people who are doing the job really love it, maybe that tells you something that you ought to listen to. And I've got to tell you, on that score, what I learned in it, I was very surprised. Very, very surprised. There were professions in there that I thought, well, of course they would like that, and they didn't. And others were, well, you know, maybe it's okay. But people who did it loved it. So it will teach you a lot. And it's less
and
than
again,
10
that,
bucks.
That just ties into the principle. Decisions should be data-driven. That's
right.
Another way to apply it.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
Get the book. I mean, you might love art, you know what I mean, and be a great artist, you know, but are you going to make any money at it? You know?
Yeah, if you're a great artist or an actor, it's real helpful if you get born if you pick really rich parents. Because don't expect to make a good living out of it.
All decisions should be data-driven, everybody. Professor, great, great show. As always, again, I really thank you so much for being available to, you know, come on and share your wisdom. Over 50 years of experience, everybody. Been doing this longer than many of the listeners have been born. So he's written a book on it, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top, okay? There's a road to the top, and you need a compass on that road. Let this book be your compass and your guide. My name is Juwanza. His name is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. Professor, I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Good enough. See you then.
All right. Take care. Everybody, make sure you get the book, The Road to the Top, 105 Business Principles. We're on the fourth edition, and again, we're going through the book principle by principle, chapter by chapter. Again, if you're loving this information, as I know that you are, you can go back into the archives, and you can just look for Professor Joseph's name, and you'll see all of the other shows that we did on entrepreneurship, and you can bring yourself up to speed. But again, you want to get the book, okay, because it's a book that if you have other people in your life that are entrepreneurs or even thinking about going into business for themselves, again, this is a big undertaking. I mean, you're talking about starting a business? I mean, really starting a business? Okay, so when you start a business, you do realize that there are going to be accountants involved. There may be lawyers involved. This is no small undertaking, okay? It takes preparation. Again, like Professor said, half of all startups fail within the first year. It doesn't mean that the people weren't talented that decided to start whatever venture they decided to start, but there's a way to do everything, okay? Now, if somebody is successful and they're saying to you that this is how I've done it, and I've written a book that can help you, and it can help guide you along the path to success, then wouldn't it be a good idea to at least find out what the person's talking about? I mean, before you jump in and start spending money and spending time doing whatever it is, okay? This book is not just principles for business, the principles for life as well. But you wouldn't know that unless you got the book, okay? I don't recommend books just to be recommending books, and I don't get anything as a result of recommending the book. I've read the book many times, okay, and I enjoy it every time. And it's one of those books, actually, that something stands out at you when you read it the next time, something else stands out. I guess stuff comes to you when you need it, right? So, again, Professor Geiger comes on every 2 weeks, normally on Tuesday, but today we did a Monday show, okay? So I just want to encourage you to get the book, and you can do this. Sometimes, you know, we're talking about business, and we're talking about accountants and lawyers and financial statements and all of that, and sometimes it seems overwhelming and it seems daunting, and you may ask yourself, can I really do this? Sure, you can do it. Other people have. You just have to be prepared. You just have to be ready. You just have to know what you're doing. You have to know what you're getting into, and you have to do your research, okay? Listen, the more you know, the less you don't know. Other people have been successful entrepreneurs. Other people that didn't even think that they could do it either did it. You can live your wildest dreams, but you just have to be prepared, okay? So, my name is Juwanza. Thank you so much for tuning in. Again, scroll through the archives. We've got shows on spirituality. We've got shows on entrepreneurship. We've got shows on holistic health. It's all there, and it's waiting for you. Until the next time, everybody, thank you so much for tuning in. You could have been doing anything, but you decided to spend the afternoon with my person and Professor Geiger. So until the next time, I certainly appreciate you. Oh, by the way, this Wednesday, July the 1st, Dr. Akmal Moorkill is going to be my special guest, and we're going to be talking about cleansing in the summer, okay? He's written a book called Cleansing Through the Seasons, Fasting Through the Seasons. Well, we're going to be talking about cleansing through the summer, okay? We're going to be talking about cleansing the blood, all right? So make sure that you tune in for that. That's this Wednesday, August the 1st, from 7 to 8 p.m., right here on Health, Wealth, and Divine. Again, my name is Juwanza. Who am I? I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you? Peace.